understand. He wouldn't come before them with nothing but his own faith in a vision he couldn't tell them about. Now he had the ancients on his side. And never mind that one of them was a Muslim, he could still build a case for his expedition. At last his marriage to Felipa paid off. He used every contact he had made and won the chance to present his ideas at court. He stood boldly before King Juan, knowing that God would touch his heart and make him understand that it was God's will that he mount this expedition with Columbus at its head. He laid out his maps with all his calculations, showing Sipangu within easy reach and Cathay but a short voyage beyond that. The scholars listened. The king listened. They asked questions. They mentioned the ancient authorities that contradicted Columbus's view of the size of the earth and the ratio of land to water, and Columbus answered them patiently and with confidence. "This is the truth," he said. Until one of them said, "How do you know that Marinus is right and Ptolemy is wrong?" Columbus answered, "Because if Ptolemy is right, then this voyage would be impossible. But it is not impossible. It will succeed. And so I know that Ptolemy is wrong." Even as he said it, he knew that it was not an answer that would persuade them. He knew, seeing their polite nods, their not-so-covert glances at the king, that their recommendation would be squarely against him. "Well," he thought, "I have done all I could. Now it is up to God." He thanked the king for his kindness, reaffirmed his certainty that this expedition would cover Portugal in glory and make it the greatest kingdom of Europe and bring Christianity to countless souls, and took his leave. He took it as an encouraging sign that, as he waited for the king's answer, he was given permission to join a trading expedition to the African coast. It wasn't a voyage of exploration, so no great secrets of the Portuguese crown were being laid before him. Still, it was a sign of trust and favor that he was allowed to sail as far as the fortress of São Jorge at La Mina. "The king is preparing me to lead an expedition by letting me become acquainted with the great achievements of Portuguese navigation." Upon his return, he eagerly awaited the king's answer, expecting to be told any day that he would be given the ships, the crew, the supplies that he needed. The king said no. Columbus was devastated. For days he hardly ate or slept. He did not know what to think. Wasn't this God's plan? Didn't God tell kings and princes what to do? How then could King Juan have refused him? "It was something I did wrong. I shouldn't have spent so much time trying to prove that the voyage was possible. I should have spent more time trying to help the king catch the vision of why the voyage was desirable, necessary, why God wanted this to be achieved. I acted foolishly. I prepared insufficiently. I was unworthy." All the explanations he could think of left him spiraling downward into despair. Felipa saw her husband suffering, and she knew that in the one thing that she had ever provided him that he desired, she had failed. He had needed a connection at court, and the influence of her family name was not enough. Why then was he married to her? She was now an intolerable burden to him. She had nothing that he could possibly desire or need or love. When she brought 5-year-old Diego to him to try to cheer him up, he sent the boy away so gruffly that the child cried for an hour and refused to go to his father again. It was the last straw. Felipa knew that Columbus hated her now, and that she deserved his hatred, having given him nothing that he wanted. So she went to bed, turned her face to the wall, and soon became exactly as ill as she declared herself to be. In her last days, Columbus became as solicitous of her as she had ever desired. But she knew in her heart that this did not mean that he loved her. Rather, he was doing his duty. And when he talked to her of how sorry he was for his long neglect, she knew that this was said not because he wished her to live so he could do better in the future, but rather because he wanted her forgiveness so that his conscience could be free when at last her death freed him in every other way. "You will have your greatness, Christovan, one way or another," she said. "And you'll be there beside me to see it, my Philippa," he said. She wanted to believe it, or rather wanted to believe that he actually desired it, but she knew better. "I ask only this promise. Diego will inherit everything from you." "Everything," said Columbus. "No other sons," she said. "No other heirs." "I promise," he said. Soon afterward, she died. Columbus held Diego's hand as they followed her coffin to the family tomb, and as they walked side by side, he suddenly lifted up his son and held him in his arms and said, "You are all I have left of her. I treated your mother unfairly, Diego, and you as well, and I can't promise to do any better in the future. But I made her this promise, and I make it to you. All that I ever have, all that I ever achieve, every title, every bit of property, every honor, every scrap of fame, it will be yours." Diego heard this and remembered it. His father loved him after all. And his father had loved his mother, too, and some day, if his father became great, Diego would be great after him. He wondered if that meant that some day he would own an island, the way grandmother did. He wondered if it meant that some day he would sail a ship. He wondered if it meant that some day he would stand before kings. He wondered if it meant that his father would leave him now, and he would never see him again. The following spring, Columbus left Portugal and crossed the border into Spain. He took Diego to the Franciscan monastery of La Rábida near Palos. "I was taught by Franciscan fathers in Genova," he told his son. "Learn well, become a scholar, and a Christian, and a gentleman, and I will be about the business of serving God and making our fortune in the process." Columbus left him there, but he visited from time to time. And in his letters to the prior, Father Juan Perez, he never failed to mention Diego and ask after him. Many sons had less of their fathers than that, Diego knew, and a small part of his dear father was far greater than all the love and attention of many lesser men. Or so he told himself to stave off the humiliation of tears during the loneliness of those first months. Columbus himself went on to the court of Spain, where he would present a much more carefully refined version of the same unprovable calculations that had failed in Portugal. This time, though, he would persist. Whatever Felipa had suffered, whatever Diego was suffering now, deprived of family and left among strangers in a strange place, it would all be justified. For in the end, Columbus would succeed, and the triumph would be worth the price. He would not fail, he was sure of it. Because even though he had no proof, he knew that he was right.
"I have no proof," said Hunapu, "but I know that I'm right." The woman on the other end of the line sounded young, too young to be influential, surely, and yet she was the only one who had answered his message, and so he would have to speak to her as if she mattered, because what other choice did he have? "How do you know you're right without evidence?" she asked mildly. "I didn't say I have no evidence, just that there can never be proof of what would have happened." "Fair enough," she answered. "All I ask is a chance to present my evidence to Kamal." "I can't guarantee you that," she said. "But you can't come to Juba and present your evidence to me." Come to Juba. As if he had an unlimited budget for travel, he who was on the verge of being dismissed from Past Watch altogether. "I'm afraid that such a journey would be beyond my means," he said. "Of course, we'll pay for your travel," she said, "and you can stay here as our guest." That startled him. How could someone so young have authority to promise him that? "Who did you say you were?" "Diego," she said. Now he remembered the name. Why hadn't he made the connection in the first place? Though it was Kamal's project to which he was determined to contribute, it was not Kamal who had found the intervention. "Are you the Diego who?" "Yes," she said. "Have you read my papers? The ones I've been posting, and..." and which no one has paid the slightest attention to? Yes. And do you believe me? I have questions for you, she said. And if you're satisfied with my answers? Then I'll be very surprised, she said. Everyone knows that the Aztec Empire was on the verge of collapse when Cortes arrived in the 1520s. Everyone also knows that there was no possibility of Mesoamerican technology rivaling European technology in any way. Your speculations about a Mesoamerican conquest of Europe are irresponsible and absurd. And yet you call me. Well, I believe in leaving no stone unturned. You're a stone that nobody's turned yet, and so you're turning me. Will you come? Yes, he said. A faint hope was better than no response at all. Send copies of all pertinent files beforehand so I can look them over on my own computer. Most of them are already in the Pastwatch system, he said. Well, then send me your bibliography. When can you come? I need to request a leave of absence on your behalf so you can consult with us. You can do that? I can request it, she said. Tomorrow, he said. I can't read everything by tomorrow. Next week, Tuesday. But send me all the files and lists I need immediately. And you'll request my leave of absence when I send the files? No, I'll request it in the next 15 minutes. Nice talking to you. I hope you aren't a crackpot. I'm not, he said. Nice talking to you, too. She broke the connection. An hour later, his supervisor came to see him. What have you been doing? She demanded. What I've always been doing, he answered. I was in the middle of writing a recommendation that you be steered to another line of work, she said, and then this comes in, a request from the Columbus Project for your presence next week. Will I grant you a paid leave of absence? It would be cheaper for you to fire me, he said, but it'll be harder for me to help them in Juba if I lose my access to the Pastwatch computer system. She looked at him in thinly veiled consternation. Are you telling me that you aren't a crazy, self-willed, time-wasting, donkey-headed fool after all? No guarantees, he said. That may end up being the list that everybody agrees to. No doubt, she said. But you've got your leave, and you can stay with us until it's over. I hope it turns out to be worth the cost, he said. It will, she said. Your salary during this leave is coming out of their budget. She grinned at him. I actually do like you, you know, she pointed out. I just don't think you've caught the vision of what Pastwatch is all about. I haven't, said Hunapu. I want to change the vision. Good luck. If you turn out to be a genius after all, remember that I never once for a moment believed in you. Don't worry, he said, smiling. I'll never forget that.
Seven. What would have been? Diko met Hunapu at the station in Juba. He was easy to recognize since he was small with light brown skin and Mayan features. He seemed placid, standing calmly on the platform, looking slowly across the crowd from side to side. Diko was surprised at how young he looked, though she was aware that the smooth-skinned Indies often seemed young to eyes accustomed to the look of other races. And, especially for one so young-looking, it was also surprising that there was no hint of tension in the man. He might have come here 1,000 times before. He might be surveying an old, familiar sight to see how it had changed, or not changed, in the years since he had been away. Who could guess, looking at him, that his career was on the line, that he had never traveled farther than Mexico City in his life, that he was about to make a presentation that might change the course of history? Diko envied him the inner peace that allowed him to deal with life so steadily. She went to him. He looked at her, his face betraying not even a flicker of expectation or relief, though he must have recognized her, must have looked up her picture in the Pastwatch roster before he came. I'm Diko, she said, extending both hands. He clasped them briefly. I'm Hunapu, he said. It was kind of you to greet me. We have no street signs, she said, and I'm a better driver than the taxis. Well, maybe not, but I charge less. He didn't smile. A cold fish, she thought. Have you any bags, she asked. He shook his head. Just this. He shrugged to indicate the small shoulder bag. Could it possibly carry so much as a change of clothes? But then he was traveling from one tropical climate to another, and he wouldn't need a shaving kit. Beardlessness was part of what made indie men seem younger than their years. And as for papers, those would all have been transmitted electronically. Most people, though, brought much more than this when they traveled, perhaps because they were insecure and needed to surround themselves with familiar things, or to feel that they had many choices to make each day when they dressed, so they didn't have to be so frightened or feel so powerless. Obviously, that was not Hunapu's problem. He apparently never felt fear at all, or perhaps never regarded himself as a stranger. How remarkable it would be, thought Diko, to feel at home in any place. I wish I had that gift. Quite to her surprise, she found herself admiring him, even as she felt put off by his coldness. The ride to the hotel was wordless. He offered no comment on the accommodation. Well, she said, I assume you'll want to rest in order to overcome jet lag. The best advice is to sleep for 3 hours or so and then get up and eat immediately. I won't have jet lag, he said. I slept on the plane. And on the train. He slept? On the way to the most important interview of his life? Well, then you'll want to eat. I ate on the train, he said. Well, then, she said, how long will you need before we start? I can start now, he said. He took off his shoulder bag and laid it on the bed. There was an economy of movement in the way he did it. He neither tossed it carelessly nor placed it carefully. Instead, he moved so naturally that the shoulder bag seemed to have gone to the bed of its own free will. Diko shuddered. She couldn't think why. Then she realized that it was because of Hunapu, the way he was standing there with nothing in his hands, nothing on his shoulder, no thing that he could hold or fiddle with or clutch to himself. He had set aside the one accessory he carried, and yet seemed as calm and relaxed as ever. It made her feel the way she felt when someone else stood too close to the edge of a precipice, a sort of empathetic horror. She could never have done that. In a strange place, alone, she would have had to cling to something familiar. A notebook, a bag, even a bracelet or ring or watch that she could fiddle with. But this man, he seemed perfectly at ease without anything. No doubt he could fling away his clothes and walk naked through life and never show a sign of feeling vulnerable. It was unnerving, his perfect self-possession. How do you do it? She asked, unable to stop herself. Do what? He asked. Stay so calm. He thought about that for a moment. Because I don't know what else to do. I'd be terrified, she said, coming to a strange place like this, putting my life's work into the hands of strangers. Yes, he said. Me too. She looked at him, unsure what he meant. You're terrified? He nodded, but his face seemed just as placid as before, his body just as relaxed. In fact, even as he agreed that he was terrified, his manner, his expression radiated the opposite message, that he was at ease, perhaps a little bored, but not yet impatient, as if he were a disinterested spectator at the events that were about to take place. And suddenly, the comments of Hunapu's supervisor began to make sense. She had said something about how he never seemed to care about anything, not even the things he cared most about. Impossible to work with, but good luck, the supervisor had said. Yet, it was not as if Hunapu were autistic, unable to respond. He looked at what was around him and clearly registered what he saw. He was polite and attentive when she spoke. Well, no matter. He was strange, that was obvious. But he had come to make a presentation, and now was as good a time as any. What do you need, she asked, to make your case? A TruSight? And a network terminal, he answered. Then let's go to my station, she said.
I was able to convince Don Enrique de Guzman, said Columbus. Why is it that only kings are immune to my arguments? Father Antonio only smiled and shook his head. Cristobal, he said, all educated men are immune to your arguments. They are flimsy, they are meaningless. You are opposed by mathematics and by all the ancients who matter. Kings are immune to your arguments because kings have access to learned men who rip your arguments to shreds. Columbus was shocked. If you believe this, Father Antonio, then why do you support me? Why am I welcome here? Why did you help me persuade Don Enrique? I was not convinced by your arguments, said Father Antonio. I was convinced by the light of God within you. You are on fire inside. I believe only God can put such a fire in a man. And so, even though I believe that your arguments are nonsense, I also believe that God wants you to sail west, and so I will help you all I can, because I also love God, and I also have a tiny spark of that fire in me. At these words, tears sprang into Columbus's eyes. In all the years of study, all the arguments in Portugal, and more recently in Don Enrique's house, no one had shown a sign of having been touched by God in support of his cause. He had begun to think that God had given up on him and was no longer helping him in any way. But now he heard words from Father Antonio, who was, after all, a greatly learned man with much respect among scholars throughout Europe, that confirmed that God was, in fact, touching the hearts of good men to make them believe in Columbus's mission. Father Antonio, if I did not know what I know, I would not have believed my arguments either, said Columbus. Enough of that, said Father Perez. Never say that again. Columbus looked at him, startled. What do you mean? Here at La Rábida, behind closed doors, you can say such a thing and we will understand. But from now on, you must never give anyone even the slightest hint that it is possible to doubt your arguments.
It is possible to doubt them, said Father Antonio.
But Columbus must never give a sign that he knows it is possible to doubt them. Don't you understand? If it is God's will that this voyage occur, then you must inspire others with confidence in it. That is what will bring you victory, Columbus. Not reason, not arguments, but faith, courage, persistence, certainty. Those who are touched by the Spirit of God will believe in you no matter what. But how many of those will there be? How many of those have there been?
Counting you and Father Antonio, said Columbus, two.
So, you will not win your victory by the force of your arguments, because they are feeble indeed. And the Spirit of God will not overwhelm everyone in your path, because God does not work that way. What do you have in your favor, Cristobal?
Your friendship, he said at once.
And your utter absolute faith, said Father Perez. Am I right, Father Antonio?
Father Antonio nodded. I see his point. Those who are weak in faith will adopt the faith of those who are strong. Your confidence must be absolute, and then others will be able to hold on to your faith and let it carry them.
So, said Father Perez, you never show doubt. You never show even the possibility of doubt.
All right, said Columbus. I can do that.
And you always leave the impression that you know much more than you're telling, said Father Perez.
Columbus said nothing, for he could not tell Father Perez that his statement was the truth.
This means that you never, never say to anyone, these are all my arguments, I've now told you everything I know. If they ask you direct questions, you answer as if you were only letting a little bit of your knowledge escape. You act as if they should already know as much as you do, and you're disappointed that they do not. You act as if everyone should know the things you know, and you despair of teaching the uninitiated.
What you're describing sounds like arrogance, said Columbus.
It's more than arrogance, said Father Antonio, laughing. It's scholarly arrogance. Believe me, Cristobal, that's exactly how they'll be treating you.
True enough, said Columbus, remembering the attitude of King Juan's advisers back in Lisbon. And one more thing, Cristobal, said Father Perez. You are good with women. Columbus raised an eyebrow. This was not the sort of thing he expected to hear from a Franciscan prior. I speak not of seduction, though I'm sure you could master those arts if you haven't already. I speak of the way they look at you, the way they pay attention to you. This is also a tool, for it happens that we live in a time when Castile is governed by a woman, a queen regnant, not just a queen consort. Do you think God leaves such things to chance? She will look at you as women look at men, and she will judge you as women judge men, not on the strength of their arguments, and not on their cleverness or prowess in battle, but rather on the force of their character, the intensity of their passion, their strength of soul, their compassion, and, this above all, their conversation. I don't understand how I'll use this supposed gift, said Columbus. He was thinking of his wife and how badly he had treated her, and yet how much she had obviously loved him in spite of it all. You can't be suggesting that I seek some sort of private audience with Queen Isabella. Not at all, cried Father Perez, horrified. Do you think I would suggest treason? No. You will meet with her publicly. That is why she has sent for you. My position as the Queen's confessor has allowed me to send letters telling about you, and perhaps that helped pique her interest. Don Luis wrote to her, offering to contribute 4,000 ducats to your enterprise. Don Enrique wanted to mount the whole enterprise himself. All of these together have made you an intriguing figure in her eyes. But what you'll receive, said Father Antonio, is a royal audience, in the presence of the Queen of Castile and her husband, the King of Aragon. Yet still, I tell you that you must think of it as an audience with the Queen alone, said Father Perez, and you must speak to her as a woman, after the way of women, and not after the way of men. It will be tempting for you to do as most courtiers and ambassadors do, and address yourself to the king. She hates that, Cristobal. I betray no confidence of the confessional when I tell you that. They treat her as if she weren't there, and yet her kingdom is more than twice as large as the king's. Furthermore, it is her kingdom that is a seafaring nation, looking westward into the Atlantic. So when you speak, you address them both, of course, for you dare not offend the king. But in all you say, you look first to the queen. You speak to her. You explain to her. You persuade her. Remember that the amount you are asking for is not large. A few ships, this will not break the treasury. It is within her power to give you those ships even if her husband disdains you. And because she is a woman, it is within her power to believe in you and trust you and grant you your prayer, even though all the wise men of Spain are arrayed against you. Do you understand me? I have only one person to persuade, said Columbus, and that is the queen. All you have to do with the scholars is outlast them. All you have to do is never, never say to them, this is all I have, this is all my evidence. If you ever admit that, they will rip those arguments to shreds, and even Queen Isabella cannot stand against their certainty. But if you never do this, their report will sound much more tentative. It will leave room for interpretation. They will be furious at you, of course, and they will try to destroy you, but these are honest men, and they will have to leave open a few tiny doors of doubt, a few nuances of phrase that admit the possibility that while they believe you are wrong, they can't be absolutely, finally certain. And that will be enough? Who knows, said Father Perez. It may have to be. When God gave me this task, thought Columbus, I thought he would open the way for me. Instead, I find that such a slender chance as this is all that I can hope for. Persuade the queen, said Father Perez. If I can, said Columbus. It's a good thing you're a widower, said Father Perez. That's cruel to say, I know, but if the queen knew you were married, it would dim her interest in you. She is married, said Columbus. What can you possibly mean? I mean that when a man is married, he is no longer half so fascinating to a woman, even a married woman. Especially a married woman, since she thinks she knows what husbands are like. Father Antonio added, Men, on the other hand, are not troubled by this aberration. Judging from my confessional, at least, I would say that men are more fascinated by married women than by single ones. Then the queen and I are bound to fascinate each other, said Columbus dryly. I think so, said Father Perez, smiling. But your friendship will be a pure one, and the children of your union will be caravels with the east wind behind them. Faith for women, evidence for men, said Father Antonio. Does that mean that Christianity is for women? Let us say rather that Christianity is for the faithful, and so there are more true Christians among women than among men, said Father Perez. But without understanding, said Father Antonio, there can be no faith, and so it remains the province of men. There is the understanding of reason, at which men excel, said Father Perez, and there is the understanding of compassion, at which women are far superior. Which do you think gives rise to faith? Columbus left them still disputing the point and finished his preparations for the journey to Cordoba, where the king and queen were holding court as they prosecuted their more or less permanent war against the Moors. All the talk of what women want and need and admire and believe was ridiculous, he knew. What could celibate priests know of women? But then Columbus had been married and certainly knew nothing about women all the same, and Father Perez and Father Antonio had both heard the confessions of many women, so perhaps they did know. Felipa did believe in me, thought Columbus. I took that for granted, but now I realize that I needed her. I depended on her for that. She believed in me even when she did not understand my arguments. Perhaps Father Perez is right, and women can see past the superficial and comprehend the deepest heart of the truth. Perhaps Felipa saw the mission that the Holy Trinity put in my heart, and it led her to support me despite all. Perhaps Queen Isabella will also see this, and because she is a woman in a place normally reserved for men, she can turn the course of fate to allow me to fulfill the mission of God. As it grew dark, Columbus grew lonely, and for the first time that he could remember, he missed Felipa and wanted her with him in the night. I never understood what you gave to me, he said to her, though he doubted she could hear him. But why couldn't she? If saints can hear prayers, why can't wives? And if she doesn't listen to me anymore, why should she? I know she will be listening for the prayers of Diego. With this thought, he wandered through the torchlit monastery until he came to the small cell where Diego slept. His son was asleep. Columbus lifted him out of his bed and carried him through the gathering darkness to his own room, to his larger bed, and there he lay with his son curled into his arm. I'm here with Diego, he said silently. Do you see me, Felipa? Do you hear me? Now I understand you a little, he said to his dead wife. Now I know the greatness of the gift you gave me. Thank you. And if you have any influence in heaven, touch the heart of Queen Isabella. Let her see in me what you saw in me. Let her love me one-tenth as much as you did, and I will have my ships, and God will bring the cross to the kingdoms of the east. Diego stirred, and Columbus whispered to him, Go back to sleep, my son. Go back to sleep. Diego nestled tighter against him and did not wake.
Hunapu walked with Diko through the streets of Juba as if he thought the naked children in the grass huts were the most natural way to live. She had never had a visitor from out of town who didn't comment on it, who didn't ask questions. Some pretended to be quite blasé, asking questions about whether the grass used to make the huts was local or imported or other nonsense that was really a circuitous way of saying, "Do you people actually live like this?" But Hunapu seemed to think nothing of it, though she could sense that his eyes took in everything. Inside Past Watch, of course, everything would be familiar, and when they reached her station, he immediately sat down at her terminal and began calling up files. He had not asked permission, but then, why should he? If he was to show her anything, he would have to be in charge. This was where she had led him, so why should he ask to use what she obviously intended him to use? He wasn't being discourteous. Indeed, he had said that he was terrified. Could this very calmness, this stillness, be the way he dealt with fear? Perhaps if he ever became truly relaxed, he would seem more tense, laughing, joking, showing emotion, engaged. Perhaps it was only when he was fearful that he seemed utterly at peace. "How much do you already know?" he asked. "I don't want to waste your time covering material you're familiar with. I know that the Mexica reached their imperial peak with the conquests of Ahuitzotl. He essentially proved the practical limits of Mesoamerican empire. The lands he conquered were so far away that Moctezuma II had to reconquer them, and they still didn't stay conquered. And you know why those were the limits?" "Transportation," she said. "It was just too far, and too hard to supply an army. The greatest feat of Aztec arms was making the connection with Soconusco, far down the Pacific coast, and that only worked because they didn't take sacrificial victims from Soconusco. They traded with them. It was more of an alliance than a conquest." "Those were the limits in space," said Hunapu. "What about the social and economic limits?" She felt as if she were being given an examination, but he was right. If he tested her knowledge first, he would know how deeply he could delve into the material that mattered, the new findings that he thought would answer the great question of why the interveners had given Columbus the mission of sailing west. Economically, the Mexica cult of sacrifice was counterproductive. As long as they kept conquering new lands, they took enough captives from warfare that the nearby territory could maintain enough of a workforce to provide food. But as soon as they began coming back from war with 20 or 30 captives instead of 2 or 3,000, they were left with a dilemma. If they took their sacrifices from the surrounding lands that they already controlled, food production would go down. But if they left those men on the land, then they would have to cut down on their sacrifices, which would mean even less power in battle, even less favor from the state god. What was his name?
Huitzilopochtli, said Hunapu.
Well, they chose to increase the sacrifices as a sort of proof of their faith, so production fell and there was hunger, and the people they ruled over were more and more upset at the taking of sacrifices, even though they were all believers in the sacrificial religion, because in the old days, before the Mexica with their cult of Huitzilopochtli, there'd be only a few sacrifices at a time, comparatively speaking, after ceremonial war, or even after Star War, and after the ball games. The Mexica were new with their profligate sacrificing. The people hated it. Their families were being torn apart, and because so many people were sacrificed, it didn't seem to be such a sacred honor anymore.
And within the Mexica culture?
The state thrived because it provided social mobility. If you distinguished yourself in war, you rose. The merchant classes could buy their way into the nobility. You could rise. But that ended immediately after Ahuitzotl, when Moctezuma virtually ended all possibility of buying your way from class to class, and when failure in war after war meant that there was little chance of rising through valor in battle. Moctezuma was in a holding pattern, and that was disastrous, since the entire Mexica social and economic structure depended on expansion and social mobility. Hunapu nodded.
"So," said Deco, "where do you disagree with any of this?"
"I don't disagree with it at all," he said. "But the conclusion that is drawn from this is that even without Cortez, the Aztec Empire would have collapsed within years."
"Within months, actually," said Hunapu. "Cortez's most valuable Indy allies were the people of Tlaxcala. They were the ones who had already broken the back of the Mexica military machine." Ahuitzotl and Moctezuma threw army after army against them, and they always held on to their territory. It was a humiliation to the Mexica, because Tlaxcala was just to the east of Tenochtitlan, completely surrounded by the Mexica Empire, and all the other people, both those who were still resisting the Mexica and those who were being ground to dust under their government, began to look to Tlaxcala as their hope of deliverance. Yes, I read your paper on this. It's like the Persian Empire after the Chaldean, said Hunapu. When the Mexica fell, it would have meant a collapse of the entire imperial structure. The Tlaxcalans would have moved in and taken over.
That's one possible outcome, said Diko.
No, said Hunapu. It's the only possible outcome. It was already underway.
Now we come to the question of evidence, I'm afraid, said Diko.
He nodded. Watch.
He turned to the true site, too, and began calling up short scenes. He had obviously prepared carefully, for he took her from scene to scene almost as smoothly as in a movie. Here is Chocla, he said, and then showed her brief clips of the man meeting with the Tlaxcalan king, and then meeting with other men in other contexts. Then he named another Tlaxcalan ambassador, and showed what he was doing. The picture quickly emerged. The Tlaxcalans were well aware of the restiveness both of the subject peoples and of the merchant and warrior classes within the Mexica homeland. The Mexica were ripe for both a coup and a revolution, and whichever one happened first would certainly trigger the other. The Tlaxcalans were meeting with leaders of every group, forging alliances, preparing. The Tlaxcalans were ready. If Cortez had not come along and thrown a monkey wrench into their plans, they would have slipped in and taken over the entire Mexica Empire, whole. They were setting it up to have every subject nation that mattered revolt all at once and throw their might behind Tlaxcala, trusting in the Tlaxcalans because of their enormous prestige. At the same time, they were going to have a coup topple Moctezuma, which would break up the Triple Alliance as Texcoco and Tacuba abandoned Tenochtitlan and joined in a new ruling alliance with Tlaxcala.
Yes, said Diko. I think that's clear. I think you're right. That's what they planned.
And it would have worked, said Hunapu. So all this talk about the Aztec Empire being ready to fall is meaningless. It would have been replaced by a newer, stronger, more vigorous empire, and, I might point out, one that was just as viciously committed to wholesale human sacrifice as the Mexica. The only difference between them was the name of the god. Instead of Huitzilopochtli, the Tlaxcalans committed their butchery in the name of Comaxtli.
This is all very convincing, said Diko, but what difference does it make? The same limits that apply to the Mexica would apply to the Tlaxcala people as well. The limits on transportation, the impossibility of maintaining a program of wholesale slaughter and intensive agriculture at the same time.
The Tlaxcala were not the Mexica, said Hunapu.
Meaning?
In their desperate struggle for survival against a relentless, powerful enemy, a struggle which the Mexica had never faced, I might add, the Tlaxcala abandoned the fatalistic view of history that had crippled the Mexica and the Toltecs and the Mayas before them. They were looking for change, and it was there to be had. By now, it was getting late in the workday, and others were gathering around to watch Hunapu's presentation. Diko saw now that the fear had left Hunapu, and so he was becoming passionate and animated. She wondered if this was how the myth of the Stoic Indi had begun. The cultural response to fear among the Indi looked like impassiveness to Europeans. Hunapu began to take her through another round of brief scenes showing messengers from the king of Tlaxcala, but now they were not going to Mexica dissidents or subject nations. It is well known that the Tarascan people to the west and north of Tenochtitlan had recently developed true bronze and were experimenting heavily with other metals and alloys, said Hunapu. What no one seems to have noticed is that the Mexica were completely unaware of this, but Tlaxcala was right on top of it. And they aren't just trying to buy the bronze, they're trying to co-opt it. They're negotiating for an alliance, and they're trying to bring Tarascan smiths to Tlaxcala. They will certainly succeed, and that means that they'll have devastating and terrifying weapons unavailable to any other nations in the area.
Would bronze make that big a difference? Asked one of the onlookers. I mean, the flint hatchets of the Mexica could behead a horse with one blow. It's not as if they didn't have devastating weapons already. A bronze-tipped arrow is lighter and can fly farther and truer than a stone-tipped one. A bronze sword can pierce the padded armor that snagged and turned away flint points and flint blades. It makes a huge difference, and it wouldn't have stopped with bronze. The Taraskans were serious in their work with many different metals. They were starting to work with iron.
No, said several at once.
I know what everybody says, but it's true. He brought up a scene with a Taraskan metallurgist working with more or less pure iron. That won't work, said one onlooker. It's not hot enough. Do you doubt that he'll find a way to make his fire hotter? Asked Hunapu. This clip is from a time when Cortez was already marching to Tenochtitlan. That's why the work with iron came to nothing. Because it hadn't succeeded by the time of the Spanish conquest, it was not remembered. I found it, because I'm the only one who believed that it mattered to try to look for it. But the Taraskans were on the verge of working with iron. So the Mesoamerican Bronze Age would have lasted for 10 years, someone asked. There's no law that says bronze has to come before iron, or that iron has to wait centuries after the discovery of bronze, said Hunapu. Iron isn't gunpowder, said Diko. Or are you going to show us Taraskans working with saltpeter? My point isn't that they caught up with European technology all in a few years. I think that would be impossible. What I'm saying is that by allying themselves with the Taraskans and controlling them, the Tlaxcalans would have had weapons that would give them a devastating advantage over all the surrounding nations. They would cause so much fear that nations once conquered might stay conquered longer, might freely send the Taraskans tribute that the Mexica would have had to send an army to bring back. The boundaries would have increased, and so would the stability of the empire. Possibly, said Diko. Probably, said Hunapu. And there's this, too. The Tlaxcala already dominated Huexotzingo and Cholula, small nearby cities, but it gives us an idea of their idea of empire. And what did they do? They interfered in the internal politics of their client states to a degree that the Mexican never dreamed of. They weren't just extracting tribute and sacrificial victims. They were establishing a centralized government with rigid control over the governments of conquered nations. A true, politically unified empire, rather than a loose tribute network. This is the innovation that made the Assyrians so powerful, and which was copied by every successful empire after them. The Tlaxcalans have finally made the same discovery 2,000 years later. But think what it did for the Assyrians, and now imagine what it will do for Tlaxcala. All right, said Diko. Let me call in mother and father. But I'm not through, said Hunapu. I was looking at your presentation to see if you were worth spending time on. You are. There was obviously a lot more going on in Mesoamerica than anybody thought, because everybody was studying the Mexica, and nobody was looking for successor states. Your approach is clearly productive, and people with a lot more authority than I have need to see this. Suddenly, Hunapu's animation and enthusiasm disappeared, and he became calm and stoic-looking again. Diko thought, this means that he's now afraid again. Don't worry, she said. They'll be as excited as I am. He nodded. When will we do this, then? Tomorrow, I expect. Go to your room, sleep. The hotel restaurant will feed you, though I doubt they have much in the way of Mexican food, so I hope standard international cuisine will do. I'll call you in the morning with our schedule for tomorrow. What about Kamal? I don't think he'll want to miss this, said Diko. Because I never even got to the transportation issue. Tomorrow, said Diko. The others were already drifting away, though some lingered, obviously hoping to speak to Hunapu directly. Diko turned to them. Let this man sleep, she said to them. You'll all be invited to his presentation tomorrow, so why make him tell things tonight that he'll tell everybody tomorrow? She was surprised to hear Hunapu laugh. She hadn't heard him laugh before, and she turned to him. What's funny? I thought when you stopped me, it was because you didn't believe in me and you were being polite with promises of meetings with Tagiri and Hassan and Kamal. Why would you think that when I was saying that I thought this was important? Diko was offended that he thought she was lying. Because I never before met someone who would do what you did, stop a presentation that you thought was important. She didn't understand. Diko, he said, most people want nothing more than to know something that people higher up don't know, to know things first. Here, you had a chance to hear all of this first, and you stop it? You wait? And not only that, you promise others who are below you in the hierarchy that they can be there too?
That's the way it is in Past Watch, said Diko. The truth will still be true tomorrow, and everybody who needs to know it has an equal claim on learning it.
That's the way it is in Juba, Hunapu corrected her. Or maybe that's the way it is in Tagiri's house. But everywhere else in the world, information is a coin, and people are greedy to acquire it, and careful how and where they spend it.
Well, I guess we surprised each other, said Diko.
Did I surprise you?
You're actually quite talkative, she said.
To my friends, he said.
She accepted the compliment with a smile. His smile in return was warm and all the more valuable because it was so rare.
Saint Angel knew from the moment that Columbus began to speak that this was not going to be the normal courtier begging for advancement. For one thing, there was no hint of boastfulness, no swagger in the man. His face looked younger than his flowing white hair would imply, giving him an ageless, gnomic look. What captivated, though, was his manner. He spoke quietly, so that all the court had to fall silent to allow the king and queen to hear him. And even though he looked equally at Ferdinand and Isabella, Saint Angel could see at once that this man knew who it was that he had to please, and it was not Ferdinand. Ferdinand had no dreams of crusade. He worked to conquer Granada because it was Spanish soil, and his dream was of a single, united Spain. He knew it could not be achieved in a moment. He laid his plans with patience. He did not have to overwhelm Castile. It was enough to be married to Isabella, knowing that in their children the crowns would be united forever. And in the meantime, he gave her great freedom of action in her kingdom as long as their military movements were under his direction alone. He showed the same patience in his war with Granada, never risking his armies in all-or-nothing pitched battles, but rather besieging, feinting, maneuvering, subverting, confusing the enemy, who knew that he meant to destroy them but could never quite find where to commit their forces to stop him. He would drive the Moors from Spain, but he would do it without destroying Spain in the process. Isabella, however, was more Christian than Spanish. She joined in the war against Granada because she wanted the land under Christian rule. She had long pressed for the purification of Spain by removing all non-Christians. It made her impatient that Ferdinand refused to let her expel the Jews until after the Moors were broken. One infidel at a time, he said, and she consented, but she chafed under the delay, feeling the presence of any non-Christian in Spain like a stone in her shoe. So when this Columbus began to speak of great kingdoms and empires in the East, where the name of Christ had never been spoken aloud, but lived only as a dream in the hearts of those who hungered for righteousness, Saint Angel knew that these words would burn like flame in Isabella's heart, even as they put Ferdinand to sleep. When Columbus began to tell that these heathen nations were the special responsibility of Spain, for we are nearer to them than any other Christian nation except Portugal, and they have set out on the longest possible voyage instead of the shortest, around Africa instead of due west into the narrow ocean that divides us from millions of souls who will flock to the banners of Christian Spain. Her gaze on him became rapt, unblinking. Saint Angel was not surprised when Ferdinand excused himself and left his wife to continue the interview alone. He knew that Ferdinand would immediately assign advisers to examine Columbus for him, and the process would not be an easy one. But this Columbus, hearing him, Saint-Angel could not help but believe that if anyone could succeed at such a mad enterprise, it was this man. It was an insane time to try to put together an exploratory expedition. Spain was at war. Every resource of the kingdom was committed to driving the Moors from Andalusia. How could the queen possibly finance such a voyage? Saint-Angel remembered well the fury in the king's eyes when he heard the letters from Don Enrique, the Duke of Sidonia, and from Don Luis de la Cerda, the Duke of Medina. If they have such money, they can afford to sink it in the Atlantic on pointless voyages. Then why haven't they already given it to us to drive the Moor from their own doorstep? He asked. Isabella was also a practical sovereign, who never let her personal wishes interfere with the needs of her kingdom or overtax its resources. Nevertheless, she saw this matter differently. She saw that these two lords had become believers in this Genovese who had already failed at the court of the King of Portugal. She had the letter from Father Juan Perez, her confessor, attesting that Columbus was an honest man who asked for nothing more than the opportunity to prove his beliefs, with his own life, if necessary. So she had invited him to Córdoba, a decision that Ferdinand patiently indulged, and she listened to him now. Saint-Angel now watched, staying as the agent of the king, to report to him all that Columbus said. Saint-Angel already knew half of his report. We can spare no funds for such an expedition at this time. As King Ferdinand's treasurer and chief tax collector, Saint-Angel knew that his duty required him to be absolutely honest and accurate, letting the king know exactly what Spain could afford and what it could not. Saint-Angel was the one who had explained to the king why he should not be angry at the dukes of Medina and Sidonia. They are paying all the tax they can afford to pay year in and year out. This expedition would happen but the once, and it would be a great sacrifice for them. We should see this not as proof that they are cheating the crown, but as proof that they truly believe in this Columbus. As it is, they pay as much toward the war out of their estates as any other lords, and to use this as a pretext to try to extract more from them would only make enemies out of them, and make many other lords uneasy as well. King Ferdinand dropped the idea, of course, because he trusted Saint-Angel's judgment on matters fiscal. Now Saint-Angel watched and listened as Columbus poured out his dreams and hopes to the queen. "What are you actually asking for?" he asked silently. It wasn't until 3 hours into the interview that Columbus finally touched on that point. "No more than 3 or 4 ships. They could be mere caravels, for that matter," he said. "This is not a military expedition. We go only to mark the path. When we return with the gold and jewels and spices of the East, then the priests can go in great fleets, with soldiers to protect them from the jealous infidels. They can spread forth through Sipangu and Cathay, the Spice Islands and India, where millions will hear the sweet name of Jesus Christ and beg for baptism. They will become your subjects, and will look to you forever as the one who brought them the glad news of the resurrection, who taught them of their sins so they can repent. And with the gold and silver, with the wealth of the East at your command, there'll be no more struggling to finance a small war against the Moors of Spain. You can assemble great armies and liberate Constantinople. You can make the Mediterranean a Christian sea again. You can stand in the tomb where the Savior's body lay. You can kneel and pray in the Garden of Gethsemane. You can raise the cross once more above the holy city of Jerusalem, over Bethlehem, the city of David, over Nazareth, where Jesus grew under the care of the carpenter and the Holy Virgin. It was like music listening to him. And whenever Saint Angel began to think that this was nothing more than flattery, that this man, like most men, was out only for his own benefit, he remembered. Columbus intended to put his own life on the line, sailing with the fleet. Columbus asked for no titles, no preferment, no wealth until and unless he returned successfully from his voyage. It gave